Hey, Dave, it's Chief. Can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Excellent, sure can. Okay, so let her kick things off shortly, and then from there, everyone else will be able to hear you, but no one else will be able to speak but you.
Great. And you can hear, this sounds good in terms of volume. I have it on speakerphone, but I could obviously pick the phone up, but it sounds good.
Just a slight echo, so you may want to take it off the speakerphone just because it's a slight echo.
Okay, let me, can you hear me now? So it's off of speaker, it should be. I'm hearing the echo too, I guess.
All right. Cool. Well, Larry, we'll get you started.
Hello, it's Loretta Kate.
Thank you. We're going to get started in just about 5 minutes.
it is. I don't think I'm going to have it. I think she just moved it to one. No, I don't know if it's a... I don't know what she calls it.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Larry Minix. We'll be starting our webinar shortly. We have people at minutes to tune in. So be patient and stand by. Thank you.
This could be horrendous enough for effort. Thank you.
Yes, is this the webinar?
It is. We'll be starting in just about 1 minute. Find a lot of people signing on you.
Yeah, I hope all this noise isn't my personal phone.
No, there's a beep. Every time someone signs on, there's a beep. So if one can just hold with us a moment, we'll start the webinar.
Thank you, sir.
This is Larry Minix on behalf of the Alliance. Welcome to this afternoon's webinar. Would remind everyone that the webinar is based on an article from Health Affairs, which was sent to you earlier today. It's entitled "The Unintended Consequences of Steps to Cut Readmissions and Reform Payment May Threaten Care of Vulnerable Older Adults." It has a prestigious group of people that wrote that article, and we're grateful to the Health Fund for their support of the article itself for this webinar. Our faculty member today is one of the authors, David Grabowski. Dr. Grabowski is a professor of healthcare policy, the Department of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School. His research focuses on the economics of aging with a particular interest in the area of long-term services and supports. Among his focused interests are the examination of the economic incentives associated with hospitalizations, relationships between Medicare and Medicaid, particularly the dually eligibles, research on the demand for private long-term care insurance, and an examination of payment incentives in Medicare and Medicaid. He's also leading a team at Harvard in the evaluation of the CMS Nursing Home Value-Based Purchasing demonstration. He's a co-editor of the Journal of Health Services and Outcomes Research Methodology, and he was the 2004 recipient of the Thompson Prize for Young Investigators from the Association of University Programs and Health Administration. Dr. Grabowski received his BA from Duke, his PhD in public policy from the Irving B. Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, and we are pleased to have him involved in this work with the Long-Term Quality Alliance. Dr. Grabowski will take about 25 or 30 minutes to walk us through content that is available to you if you're at your computer, and then we will do the remainder of the time for question and answer, and you can begin lodging those questions on the computer as we go along, and we'll have time for people to be in a queue to ask a question directly by phone. So thank you all for attending today. You will hear periodic beeps as people join the call. We have been pleasantly overwhelmed with the number of people in these two webinars that want to hear about this issue. And it is a pleasure and an honor to introduce David Grabowski to you. David?
Great. Thank you, Larry, and I appreciate that introduction and, of course, the invitation to give this webinar today. And I also wanted to thank Doug Pace and everyone else at LPQA. I've served on the quality measurements work group at LPQA, and I share their goal of identifying reliable and valid measures of quality for long-term services and supports. So I'm delighted today to talk about our recently published Health Affairs paper. I'm here on behalf of my co-authors. I just wanted to quickly introduce those co-authors, Mary Naylor, Ellen Kurtzman, Charlene Harrington, Mark McClellan, and Susan Reinhard. And just to echo Larry, we also want to recognize and thank the Commonwealth Fund for supporting this work. So as a way of introduction today, as many of you know, a main emphasis of the Affordable Care Act was on encouraging a more system-based model of care. What I mean by a system-based model of care here is a system in which services are coordinated within and across settings, both payments for those settings, but also the organization and delivery of services. A good system has a number of key attributes, but an important one is the effective management of transitions across settings. As an individual moves from the community to the hospital to a skilled nursing facility, maybe back to a home care program, are those transitions effectively managed? And we obviously want to prevent those unnecessary transfers, those that are avoidable. But also, when the transition is necessary, we want to ensure that the transition occurs in a manner that maximizes patient welfare. We have a large body of research suggesting we often don't manage these transitions all that well.
And as such, there's a real area of opportunity for the Affordable Care Act to improve the way that, transitions are coordinated. There are several parts of the Act that actually do address transitions. I'm going to talk about those parts today, three important provisions within the Act. But I think, although that's the good news, the not-so-good news for those of us that live and work and study long-term services and supports is that, in many regards, these provisions within the ACA ignored those with long-term services and supports. And that's really the main point of I think, this paper and the talk today, is that because the population requiring long-term services and supports was ignored, there are a lot of potential unintended consequences of the ACA for those individuals receiving long-term services and support. With that introduction and kind of overview, I'll just go ahead here and dive into the talk and start here. Let's see if I can... Great. Start with a little bit of an introduction of just long-term services and supports. Reviewing all of you that were scheduled to attend today, I realize many of you know much more about this slide than I do. You live and work in this sector and are quite involved here. But for those who maybe are coming from other areas of healthcare and interested in how sort of long-term services and supports fits in the bigger picture, let me spend a slide getting us all kind of on common footing. So we define long-term services and supports as assistance with activities of daily living, like bathing or dressing, or instrumental activities of daily living, like cooking or grocery shopping, for example. This population is large, and it's growing considerably, and over the next several decades with the aging baby boomers, this population is going to be that much more prevalent as a percentage of the overall population in the U.S., and we're seeing similar trends in other countries as well. Today, however, in the U.S., we have in the community about 10 to 11 million individuals requiring long-term services and supports, and 1.8 million individuals requiring that they're living in a nursing home. So it's a large population that's only expected to get larger over time. I'm hearing a ringing. Are other people? I don't know where that's coming from. But,
we do not know why that is happening.
I will keep going then. Sorry about that, everyone. This is a sick population. It's a medically complex population, and it's a chronically ill population. There's frequent changes in health, and these changes in health, as we touched on earlier, require oftentimes transitions across settings, moving once again from the community to the hospital or to a skilled nursing facility, for example. This is an expensive population. They represent a disproportionate share of spending. They spend a large percentage of the Medicare budget, a large percentage of the Medicaid budget as well. And unfortunately, in spite of all that we spend on this population, it is the case that we often don't get very strong performance in terms of the different quality measures that are out there. There's a lot of waste in terms of unnecessary spending on this population. A number of avoidable hospitalizations occur in this population, for example, and there's a number of other metrics that suggest poor quality. The focus of this paper and talk today is really around transitions, and this is an issue that's received a lot of attention in the health services and aging literature, and also obviously from the policy community as late. But let me take a slide just to explain why the focus on transitions. This is obviously a really important issue for older adults receiving long-term services and support. These transitions are often associated with poor health outcomes. Individuals who are unnecessarily transferred across settings have accelerated cognitive and physical functioning decline. There's a high rate of iatrogenic events, such as hospital-acquired pneumonia, for example, or medical errors. There are unmet needs. Patients don't like these burdensome transitions, and caregivers also suffer from these transitions. Not only is it associated with lower quality and patient satisfaction, but they're also quite costly. And so it's a lose-lose of sorts. We get lower quality, lower satisfaction coupled with higher spending. We see excessive use around these transitions of expensive healthcare settings like emergency departments, inpatient hospital stays, post-acute care as well. So, I think what's really encouraging and disconcerting at the same time is that we actually do have some models out there that can improve upon the transition across settings, preventing those unnecessary transitions and effectively managing those that do need to occur. This is from this slide is based on a paper Mary Naylor and her colleagues published last year in Health Affairs. They reviewed 21 randomized controlled trials of different hospital-to-home innovations targeting chronically ill older adults. And 9 of these programs actually had a positive impact on at least one measure of readmission plus other health outcomes, suggesting, you can read Mary's paper for all the details here, but I think the main takeaway from this slide is that there are models out there that work. And I think that's the good news. The less good news and the more disconcerting part of this is that in many instances, these models aren't used all that often in practice. And we don't generally do a very good job out there in the real world in terms of managing transitions. And why is that? Why in the face of having good evidence of how to better manage these transitions, why can't we apply this evidence and do better? And this is really where the policy environment fails us. Under the current fragmented payment and delivery system, there's really little incentive to invest in better transitional care models. Those providers that invest in these models oftentimes incur the cost without enjoying the benefits. The savings go elsewhere in the system, oftentimes to the Medicare or Medicaid programs or for other providers or payers downstream. And so this suggests there's a real opportunity for reform. We have models that work and a policy system that doesn't encourage these models. And so not surprisingly, under this opportunity for reform, we saw several parts of the Affordable Care Act that were designed to address transitions. And I'm going to talk about three of these parts of the Act today. And these are all programs that illustrate opportunities to improve transitional care within the Medicare population. And they're all directed at the Medicare population, but there's a real opportunity, obviously, for those with long-term services and supports as well. And I'll say as an overarching comment, and I'll come back to this point time and again here throughout the talk, but unfortunately, all of these policies or all of these parts of the Affordable Care Act were all very general or directed at different populations, not really including those requiring long-term services and support. And that's really where the unintended consequences arise for this population. They really weren't considered as part of the policy or the act itself. And so there's this real potential that by omitting them, you actually may make individuals requiring long-term services and supports worse off. And so I'm going to talk through each of these three different reforms, the Hospital Readmissions Reduction Program, the National Pilot Program on Payment Bundling, and the Community-Based Care Transitions Program. And with each
of... Can you pause you for just a moment and read me all the lines again?
Yeah, thank you.
One second.
What does that mean?
All right, thank you, David. Continue, please.
Yes. All right, thanks. So I'm going to talk about each of these three sections within the ACA. First, describing the reform, and then spending a little bit of time talking about the potential unintended consequences of the reform for those individuals receiving long-term services and support. So let's start with the Hospital Readmissions Reduction Program. I'll once again, provide an overview of this, and then kind of dive into the potential barriers for those with LTSS needs. So, beginning in October of 2013, hospitals with excessive severity or risk-adjusted readmission rates calculated over 30 days will be financially penalized. That means they will not receive full reimbursements if they have these excessive readmissions. So, individuals being discharged at 30-day period. If they're bouncing back to the hospital at high rates, there'll be a payment decrease for these for those hospitals. And initially, the policy is going to be limited to three target conditions: heart failure, and acute myocardial infarction. And we will expand to other conditions in 2015. Within 2 years of the law's enactment, the quality improvements provided to hospitals through the patient safety organizations. And I want to emphasize this point and come back to it. The support will be just to the hospital, won't be to the discharge settings. And so it's really the idea that all of the burden here is on the hospitals to really figure out ways to better discharge their patients, such that they don't aren't readmitted to the hospital over the next 30 days. Ideally, if this program works and improves transitional care, it should motivate behaviors on the part of hospitals to prevent those avoidable readmissions, and obviously improve outcomes for Medicare beneficiaries. Among those beneficiaries would be those frail elders receiving long-term services and supports. That's kind of the ideal here. Once again, it's purely a stick. There's no carrot here. It's a punishment or a penalty if hospitals have excessive rates of readmission for these conditions. We can all sort of imagine some ways in which this might not work very well for the population with requiring long-term services and supports. Let me just talk through a few of these. This is a very blunt instrument in penalizing hospitals. It has the potential to actually improve care for everyone, but it also has the potential to really have some unintended consequences for this selected population. Obviously, the reasons for hospitalization among those receiving long-term services and supports don't fully stink. That's a very short list: AMI, heart failure, pneumonia. There's a whole host of reasons that individuals are hospitalized to require long-term services and supports. And so there is some disconnect between that list and what's being penalized by the Act. There's also this idea that the quality improvement opportunities are only geared towards the hospital. There's no effort to sort of coordinate services between acute and long-term service providers. That's really what we'd hope for, right, that hospitals would choose to work more closely with discharge settings, whether it's SNFs, whether it's other providers of long-term services and supports. But there's nothing either through the payment, the penalty, or the quality improvement activities that surround the penalty that actually encourage coordination. That's left up to the hospitals themselves. The other issue.
Everyone still with us? Did we lose everybody?
No, they're still there. I don't know where they went. They went right away to them.
Hello?
Maybe you're still there?
Yes, did the call end?
No, it didn't end. Hold on, we just lost the speaker. Hold on 1 second, please. David, are you still on the call?
I am on the call. I've been on it, but it bumped me over to you.
Okay, we're trying to locate the speaker.
Should I hang up and call in again?
Just hold a moment, please.
We lost our speaker. We don't know where he went.
Hello?
Oh, hello?
Yes.
Everyone hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Sorry, I somehow my line was muted there.
Yeah, that was on our end. You should be good to go now. Go ahead.
All right. Thanks. So the next point, I'm not sure where I was cut off, but I'll start with kind of the third main bullet on this slide here. Preventing readmissions is known to be quite costly, and given this investment, there's some risk that some providers, especially those in sort of safety net providers that make care for large percentages of individuals requiring long-term services and support, may incur the penalty rather than the cost of preventing readmissions. Finally, we know that providers respond to incentives in different ways, and one potential response here, unintended consequence, would be the use of coding to avoid measurement of some readmissions. For example, we've seen a real emergence of observation stays in recent years, and so there's a real concern here that we might see something similar in order to avoid any sort of penalty. So the second policy that I wanted to discuss today is the National Pilot Program on Payment Bundling. This is a five-year pilot that begins that will be established by January 2013 to evaluate an episode-based integrated care delivery and payment program. It'll be structured around an acute care hospital. There's different models that are out there that are being proposed. There's actually four that CMS is working through as part of the bundled payment care initiative. But the longest episode covered would be 3 days before the hospital admission through 30 or 90 days post-hospital discharge. And by bundled payment here, we mean all of the providers, the hospital, the physician, outpatient providers, post-acute care providers, would all receive a bundled rate that CMS would pay a fixed amount for their care to all of these providers. The idea is that it would reduce the spending and potentially improve quality. The incentive is to deliver care in the lowest cost setting within the bundle, maximize operating margins for the provider, and avoid those expensive post-acute stays, those expensive preventable readmissions as well. So there's real potential here to better kind of maximize care here. One of the concerns is stinting, obviously, that we don't want to, but the goal would be some sort of quality oversight where providers, if paid under a bundle, would lower costs here and provide more cost-effective care. So what are some of the barriers from the perspective of this population requiring long-term services and support? Well, as I listed all those providers that were in the bundle, you saw one that was missing. The bundle excludes long-term services and supports. Some of that is a short window here, the 30 or 90-day window. However, this really is a real concern because, one, imagine the individual who's a long-staying nursing home resident who's hospitalized. The bundle says nothing about that initial hospitalization. There's still that incentive to create the bundle. And then once in the bundle and in receiving services, the individual is going to go back to that potentially to that same nursing home, and all of the management there's no integration with that nursing home either on the front end of the bundle or after the period has ended. And so this really doesn't create that kind of meaningful integration between long-term care providers and other acute, post-acute, primary care, and community-based providers. The other concern here that I've written some about is that hospitals may actually limit their referral networks in the context of bundled payment, and then they begin to work very narrowly with other providers that are in the bundle, and this may cause greater segmentation in the nursing home market, for example, where certain nursing homes work with other providers and deliver post-acute services. Other providers only deliver long stay services, and so this market segmentation may be good from some perspectives if we want greater specialization, but it also may pose a negative in that under the current system there's there's a lot of work suggesting that Medicare subsidizes via spillovers, cross-subsidizes Medicaid care in a number of nursing homes, that higher revenue Medicare payments are very important to the skilled nursing facility sector. So the final issue here, and I raised this on the previous slide, but let me say it again, is that whenever you pay by a bundle, there's always this concern that there's going to be stinting or withholding or denying of care, and also this idea that there's some shifting of cost to the post-bundle period. And I think for individuals requiring long-term services and supports, this is really a concern, because for many of these individuals who are in Medicaid-financed settings prior to the bundle or following the bundle, there's a real concern about quality of care and resources. And so if there's an opportunity here to integrate the two, that would actually be much more preferred. So let me talk quickly about the third policy, and that's community-based care transitions. This maybe most closely links with our interest in this paper and webinar today in transitions. $500 million was made available to community-based organizations to partner with one or more hospitals with high readmission rates, and the idea here was that they could come up with models to provide better transitional care services. They would implement some of those evidence-based care transition services like Mary and her colleagues talked about in that 2011 Health Affairs paper, but timely post-discharge follow-up, self-management support, comprehensive medication review and management, so a number of potential services here to improve transitions. And the idea would be to target those high-risk Medicare beneficiaries, and they're very specific criteria here, those who have been diagnosed with multiple chronic conditions or possess other factors such as cognitive impairment, depression, or a history of multiple readmissions that otherwise places them at risk. So there's a very kind of narrow, tight restriction, and obviously that's going to overlap with those individuals requiring long-term services and supports, but maybe not identically, and I'll come back to that point in a moment. But just in terms of thinking about some of the barriers here, we're obviously using the hospital as the hub here, and some of those frail older adults who receive long-term services and supports are likely to be missed if they aren't hospitalized, for example, or live outside of one of the geographic areas where these programs are in place. Patients requiring long-term services and supports may overlap with the criteria I described on the previous slide, but they may have physical, mental, functional disabilities that are a little bit different than those outlined within the criteria, and so they may not be eligible here. And then finally, I find this most disconcerting. It's a Medicare-only benefit, and I've written once again a lot about the need to sort of coordinate Medicare and Medicaid payments here if we're talking about this population and want to coordinate long-term services and supports with other healthcare services for older adults. So without any specific mandate to align, integrate, or coordinate with Medicaid or private insurers, we're not going to have any alignment, integration, or coordination. And so I think that's somewhat disconcerting. So what do we do next? I think in many regards, the ACA was a comprehensive set of reforms, but it's a first step. And regardless as to what happens in the election in November, I think we're going to continue to see change in this area. And what we'd like to do is sort of think through kind of some of the potential next steps going beyond the Affordable Care Act. So first, I think thinking about the changes that I've talked about today, the readmissions reduction program, the payment bundling program, and the community-based care transitions program, I think we need to anticipate the unintended consequences, identify those negative effects through warning signs, longitudinally monitor consequences, and then obviously work towards enhancing those existing performance measures and available data. I talked a little bit at the outset of how I serve on a work group at LTQA, and LTQA has been involved in trying to come up with appropriate measures for this population, but I think that's an ongoing effort and one we want to continue to work towards and then actually apply in terms of the evaluation of different policies. Obviously, then we want to advance additional payment and regulatory policies that serve to integrate care. We have left long-term services and support out of many of these policy reforms. And as we move forward, how do we think about introducing new reforms that include long-term services and supports? And to the extent that we have enacted policies like the readmission penalty, is there a way to extend that to include long-term services and support providers as part of either the penalty, but also the quality improvement? Is there a way to include long-term care populations in bundling, for example? There's a lot of opportunities there, and there might be an opportunity to go back and reform some of these existing policies. Finally, and I think this is a broader goal, and this will sort of lead into the next slide, but we need to promote delivery system reform. And as I mentioned earlier, these reforms are not inexpensive. They're costly to providers. And so to the extent that we can provide support to providers for new models of transitional care, I think that would obviously stimulate the adoption of these programs. More generally, I think we want to move towards a system, and this is kind of the broader kind of takeaway that brings to, a system that brings together acute, post-acute, and the long-term care communities to implement reforms that obviously improve health and lower costs, and particularly for those individuals requiring long-term services and support. We want to include support and for all the key stakeholders here: providers, consumers, payers, and purchasers. And there are examples of different models that are coming online that have the potential to engage all the players: accountable care organizations, medical and health homes, episode-based payments. But to date, all of these models have sort of left long-term services and supports on the side. Most recently, I attended, for example, an ACO Congress where there was discussion of applying the ACO model for the dually eligible population. And that effort is still quite early and certainly not incorporated into at the policy level. And so I think we have a long way to go, even with these models, that we could see exactly how long-term care could fit in the broader framework. We have a long way towards realizing that goal. LTQA can obviously facilitate educational forums like this and other reform initiatives that advance comprehensive reforms. And just to sum up then before I open it up for questions, several provisions within the ACA attempted to address transitional care. Unfortunately, they didn't address it adequately for those individuals receiving long-term services and supports, and in many instances, they may have introduced more unintended consequences than actually improved transitional care for this population. As we move forward, further policy action is needed to address these potential emerging risks. I'll just conclude with a slide to let anyone else who wants to get involved in this issue. There's a lot of enthusiasm, I think, among the set of co-authors, the Commonwealth Fund, and LTQA to continue to think both on the ground and at the policy level of models that can improve the payment delivery organization of services. And so I didn't ask him if I could do this, but I put Doug's email here as a contact, and I'll let him be a contact here for individuals who want to get involved. I'll stop on that point, Larry, and turn it back to you and open it up for questions.
All right. Thank you very much, David. For those of you who want to get in the queue to ask a question, punch *2. And while you're lining up to do that, let me give you a question that came in through the email route. It said, what quality measures, David, would you recommend to measure unintended consequences among persons who receive long-term services and supports and are yet enrolled in a Medicare, Medicaid integrated plan? What are those measures, David, as you see them?
Absolutely. So I think whenever we're thinking about unintended consequences, we always first want to think about selection. What I mean by that is who's entering the program. Are certain individuals being excluded? Does it look like the rest of the dually eligible population? So I'm always concerned. My first check whenever I'm thinking about unintended consequences, are there what we term selection effects? Who's selecting into the program? And that could either be the individuals themselves who don't want to enter into this program, or it could be the program, for whatever reason, attracting certain types of individuals. I think the second concern with these types of programs, whenever you bundle payments or enact penalties, is stinting on care. I think we want to look at utilization patterns and making certain there aren't unmet needs. So I think utilization is spending. And then finally, I think the usual set of quality metrics are so important here, both those that are measured and those that are unmeasured within the program. I've been involved, for example, in the nursing home value-based purchasing demonstration, Larry, that you mentioned at the outset. You know, we're looking, for example, in the nursing home population at readmissions. We're looking at nursing home deficiencies. We're looking at staffing. We're looking at a number of MDS quality measures. We're also looking at other MDS quality measures, for example, that aren't rewarded by the program, to make certain that providers aren't shirking on those unmeasured dimensions of quality. And so I think just to kind of run through the list again, I think you want to look at selection. I think you want to look at use of services and unmet needs. And then I think you want to look at different quality metrics. And I think both those that the usual suspects, if you will, those that are included under the program, and also those that maybe unmeasured or those where providers may not have an incentive, because we want to make certain they're not seeing a decline in quality in other parts of the system.
All right, I think we got a couple of questions in the queue.
The next question is from
Loretta Cage, re-signing in.
Your line is now open.
Hi, I was wondering, do you have any information or any feeling about HMOs replacing a bundled payment at any time? Because some states already have HMOs for the Medicaid payment source.
Yeah, that's a great question, and not something we talked about in this paper, but something you know, that's been written about by this group of co-authors and other places, including myself. But I think there's a lot of potential for Medicare Advantage, and more particularly to this population, the special needs plans, the SNPs, to serve as a potential way of coordinating care. To date, I think we haven't seen strong enrollment in most states in those plans, and to the extent that we have seen enrollment, I don't know that they've looked all that different from other Medicare Advantage plans. One of the really neat parts of the ACA are these coordinated care demonstrations, and that may have been what you were referring to, that I think a lot of the states, 15 states were given money to develop a coordinated care plan for the dual eligible population, and a number of them are using managed care as a way of bundling services. And I think there's real concerns about how meaningful that blending of Medicare and Medicaid will be. It's one thing to offer both sets of services in managed care. It's another to offer a truly blended product that integrates both the funding streams up top, then also the services on the ground. And I think that's where the real challenge will be. In theory, I think those kinds of models here would work great. There's always a concern about whether you know, frail elders will enroll in those plans, and the selection issues I discussed earlier, but I think the potential is quite large there. And in many ways, if you sort of think through the details of it, and I won't go into it unless someone wants me to today, but when I hear about an accountable care organization and how it works, and I hear about a special needs plan, for example, there's a lot of commonality there, and it's just in some ways a different way of integrating payments and delivery for beneficiaries. They both have elements of a capitated model, and that's very there's a lot of commonality and a lot of similarities in how they're getting at a common problem there of coordinating services across settings. But thanks for that question.
And the same pitfalls then apply, yes, to the okay.
Absolutely. There's been potential for unintended consequences with enrollment, with stinting, with all the problems we've discussed. So, same promise, but same pitfalls, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Go ahead. The next question is from
Lisa Sophia.
Your line is now open.
Hello?
Yes,
yeah,
hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling, well, I'm wondering if you'd be able to offer some advice. We have, my organization has been working very closely with our area hospitals regarding the 30-day readmissions and decreasing them for these diagnoses. And a couple of things have been happening. One, the hospital has been getting a pretty aggressive with us and other long-term care providers in the area that I speak to all the time. If someone is going back out to the hospital and getting admitted with these DRGs to the point where they are calling us up the next day and raising the roof with us and demanding an explanation, et cetera. The other is that we're kind of feeling as though they are in the power position right now. We have been told, along with the other long-term care providers in our area, that if we send these people back with this DRG, they're not going to do business with us anymore. I mean, they are really under the pressure here, you know, with their corporate heads as far as keeping these penalties down. The other thing is, last week when we were out meeting with our area hospitals, which we do every month and bring us, you know, we're working on programs together, is that they told us that beginning on Monday of this week that they will no longer be reimbursed for the diagnosis of syncope. So therefore, we had to go back and trying to put a program together for syncope. How can we better get information ahead of time so that, you know, we know how to be working proactively with these hospitals? I know that Leading Age and Leading Age PA has been doing a fantastic job of trying to get us more information. It just seems like it's not coming fast, you know, as fast as the hospitals are getting it. The other challenge that we have is that various hospitals around here are using different programs with these 30-day admissions. So it's trying to, you know, we had one hospital say, if you don't use our program, we're not doing business with you. So it's becoming extremely difficult. And my fear is that people are really going to start shying away from people that do need to go out to those ERs in 30 days.
Right. No, I think your comment provides a nice case study and real support for some of the unintended consequences that we outline in the paper. So thank you for that comment. I think as CMS, you know, as the policy is designed, it's supposed to make hospitals try to work with those providers that have the lowest probability readmitting those patients for these conditions. But as you're suggesting, there's real potential here to get hospitals too much market power here. And it's also the unintended consequence of saying individuals who may need to go to the ER, as you just suggested, or back into the hospital at the margin. I think hospitals are saying don't send them back, or giving you a lot of pushback when you do try to send them back. So I think there's a real, we can err in the other direction of inappropriate non-hospitalization in some instances, and also giving these hospitals too much market power. And I think it goes back to this broader comment I made during the talk, that if we had engaged hospitals and long-term care providers and other post-acute discharge sites together from the beginning and the policy, both are rewarded or both are, you know, there's not appropriate skin in the game. There's not, the quality improvement is not across the two sites. And so I really don't like these penalties up top that can be enacted in a lot of ways down low on the ground. And I'm not a fan of this kind of approach. You know, I think penalties can work, but I also think they require a lot of sort of coaching in terms of models, as you discussed. Every hospital may have their own model here, in terms of best practices. So, it's a great window into how things are happening on the ground. And I think your experience, I've talked to nursing home providers in other markets, and they're saying very similar things, that hospitals are very worried about this policy and talking to them a lot. And on the one hand, I think that communication is good. On the downside, however, I don't always think it's led to better coordination of care. So to answer your question of how you can find these things out more quickly, I think this is in such a dynamic environment that I think, I wouldn't be the right person to answer that question, but I think it sounds like maybe someone at Leading Age might they've done a good job of sort of getting out these changes. I mean, I think things have been so dynamic and from a policy perspective that I don't actually, I don't think the hospitals have been able to anticipate some of this until you hear about it. So I think things have been changing incredibly rapidly. Thanks for the question.
I can comment on that. We had a CMS official at a recent meeting that answered honestly, they don't have all the rules and answers yet themselves. I think we're all in a situation where we're rebuilding an airplane in flight, turning it into a space shuttle to dock with a space station that isn't finished yet. And I think we're going to be living with that for a while, which gets me to a question on the screen. The writer says that he was in a program with well-respected Stuart Allman recently, who emphasized the growing linkage between acute and post-acute and long-term services and supports. Given all the reforms that are likely to take 5 to 10 years to really prove themselves, what should providers be doing over the next 2 to 3 years to get ready for all this and be a responsible player in this new era? What would you say, David?
No, that's a great question. I think Stuart in his session is correct. I think there's a lot of aspects of the law that downstream will encourage greater integration here. The coordinated care demonstrations in those 15 states I mentioned, and that's been expanded past those initial 15 as well. I think there's real signs of greater integration. So I think that's the way the world is moving. It's just slow. In terms of what providers could be doing, I think there's a number of steps here in terms of working with other providers. I think the ability to kind of manage, I think there's a lot of knowledge in among long-term care providers that needs to be brought out and spread to the more general healthcare provider community. And so how do we, I think as we're moving forward, I hope that long-term care providers will join these networks, will play a role, plan to join these kinds of initiatives, because I think that's where we're going with the duals. That's where we're going with a lot of these populations. So I think being open to these kinds of payments and delivery models that integrate services. I think we're all going to be living in that environment down the road, and so this siloed nature of our system to date, where long-term care was thought of as being very distinct from other settings, those days are over, as we all know who live and work and research this area. But I think to the extent we can further integrate with other provider communities. The other area I'll mention quickly would be information technologies, and I think that's an area where it'll be a real barrier as we try to sort of bridge these different settings. And I know there's been investment in all of the settings, but interoperability is a real concern as we think about how to kind of make this work. But I think, and then as maybe a final thought, that I think historically we've all thought very narrowly, oftentimes, about our own kind of bottom line. That those were the incentives, and I think we should all recognize that once we sort of join these networks, there's real opportunity for innovation, And, you know, there's going to be programs, you know, just to name a couple around transitions, the Interact Toolkit or telemedicine. There's all sorts of opportunities to implement programs that may not make sense for the provider in the current payment system. But once we begin to kind of integrate payments and providers, settings, there's real opportunities to think outside the box. And so I'd encourage the provider community to both think broadly here in terms of innovation, because I think as the world changes, there'll be real opportunities for new models.
David, as a final question, kind of a bottom line kind of thing, in 5 years, what will the successful providers be doing that the losers fail to do?
Oh, I think providing coordinated services, and what I mean by that is not just coordinated health services, but coordinating health and long-term care services, and doing that because the payments up top are encouraging that, but also down on the ground, the organization and delivery encourages that, and we're sort of pairing payments that encourage integration and coordination with kind of delivery models, and I think that the I think that's going to be the real buzzword kind of moving forward, that the best models will be systems, true systems. We often talk about the healthcare system, but it's really not a system, as you know, Larry. It's a loosely grouped set of providers, but I think we're really going to move towards systems and networks, and I think that's where we're seeing the best outcomes right now, are in these communities where we have more integrated, coordinated care delivery models. I'll name two that get a lot of attention, but Kaiser and Geisinger, to use two examples. And I think there's a lot of other providers out there that are adopting this approach as well, and showing quite good outcomes. And so I think that's what a good provider will look like in 5-10 years. Of working across the silos that currently kind of serve as barriers towards well-integrated care.
David Grabowski, we thank you very much for your very important work, for your involvement with the LTQA, for your co-authorship on this article. We encourage everyone to read it. We encourage you all to get involved in the LTQA. You can go online. It's easy to do, and there are varying levels of financial support you could offer, but the LTQA is getting known for this kind of work that will help all of us do a better job in the future. So thank you, David. We'll be on the lookout for all of your good stuff that you're doing. Those participants will email you a survey, which we encourage you to reply to and give us feedback on. And have a great day out there. Thank you all very much. And David, great. Thank you especially.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks, everyone. Oh.